consultant here at the school. I'm a practicing social epistemologist, a theoretical one. And I have some scholarly interests in various things, which I really just cultivate as an independent scholar, so to speak. My institution, I can't really be. I do some external lecturing here and stuff, and that's the nature of the connection there. I've been asked to do two things, and I have about 15 minutes, so I'm not going to give them equal time, but one of them is to introduce Steve's book, Humanities 2.0, and I'm going to try to do that in the kind of most invigorating and provocative and stimulating way I can think of. And I think you'll see what I mean. I may regret this, but I've done this advisedly, so maybe against better advice, but advisedly nonetheless. And then I'm going to try to say something about my own position within that universe. And I think anyone who's read Steve knows why I'm going to do it this way. When you read pretty much any book by Steve, you find out that many of the positions that you might take in the book have already been identified. Right? So you're sort of given a space in which to engage dialectically with the work. And I think that challenge is very important. So I'm just going to start. You may hurt a little, and then remember it's only going to last about 15 minutes. I invite you to think creatively about politics in the age of histamine. I invite you to think creatively about politics. Given men as they are, asthmatic, out of tune in time, out of bounds in practice, I invite you to run your mouth, to run your hands through my thin air like a theme. I invite you to lean your head against my better judgment. Once uncertainty ran through these sketches like a lab. Now of my early work, a critic has said, it was open, so I let myself in. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's weather has been canceled. The Academy has condemned the blue tit. The poor are stealing the salt licks. Grenades luxuriate in the garden of decommissioned adjectives. It is the Sabbath. I must invite you to lay down your knowledge claims, to lay them down slowly and with great sadness. Given men as they are, women pack snow into jars for the summer ahead. Given men as they are, the trees surrender. What a poetry. I will explain in a moment. Norman Mailer was fond of quoting André Gide. He said, please do not understand me too quickly. Please do not understand me too quickly. And I always think that would be a good slogan for Steve. And certainly something his critics might keep in mind. You immediately understand what Steve is on about. And I would also very much encourage you to give me that courtesy as well. Do not understand me too quickly, and especially do not understand what I'm going to try to maybe attribute to Steve too quickly either. This is not in any way intended as an authoritative reading. And the easiest example of this in Humanity 2.0 is probably this kind of sympathy for the devil argument that is present in there, where he asks us to consider the possibility that Nazi Germany, quote, represents some latent good that deserves to be preserved in some sublimated form, in some future ideal, or at least improved version of the human condition. He asks us to rewind history to about 1920, 1930, and kind of imagine what could have happened, what good could have come of that. And so we really have to ask ourselves, is Steve really suggesting that we try Nazism again? Right? And especially the kind of eugenics program in that. Is he really saying, come on, there was some good in thinking about the perfectionability of the species. And of course, this time, there is no kind of countervailing allied force that might be brought in to interfere with that. And I think that's why we have to take this possibility very seriously. Because if the first run of this had a possible countervailing force, the second one doesn't seem like it won't have one. There isn't anything stronger, I mean, barring alien invasion or something like that. This is going to, whatever this is, it's going to happen. And so we have to take it seriously in that sense. But certainly, if it can't be a full-born rerun, like a Nazism 2.0, or if so, then certainly we would hope policymakers aren't going to understand that idea too quickly. Right? So that's really where I think we have to think about this quite seriously. Now, one way to slow that hermeneutic down, as it were, is to shift from that biological utopia that you found in Nazi Germany to what we might call a technological utopia that was unfolding, in fact, earlier in fascist Italy, right? Which Wyndham Lewis interestingly called a kind of spectacular marionettian flourish on the tail or head of Marxism, right? Which is an interesting way of putting it, a kind of marionettian futurist kind of flourish, but certainly a kind of a technological version of it. And he said that in a chapter of a book that's got a very nice title, The Art of Being Ruled. The Art of Being Ruled, which came out in 1926, so about that time to which we want to rewind history and see how it could have run. And interestingly, this chapter is called Fascism as an Alternative. Fascism as an Alternative. And we want to ask ourselves, an alternative to what? Right? That's really the important question. But what's very important to keep in mind is that in the 1920s, you have people like Wyndham Lewis and Ezra Pound, of course, perhaps more famously or infamously, who were openly fascist, right? Who don't, as we do today, see how enormously embarrassing it is to be a fascist, right? So they're proposing it as just one of the possible alternatives. You have kind of a liberal democracy alternative, you have a Soviet communism alternative, and then one of the possibilities would be fascism or Nazism. So we need to get into this question of what is it proposed as an alternative to. And I think this is where really we can challenge some things in Steve's book, in Humanity 2.0. So I'm going to say some slightly less provocative and less spectacular things about the statement in that book for a moment. What Steve does is he says Humanity 2.0, sort of the next version of humanity, is the emerging object of social science and social policy in the 21st century. Right? And this is very important to keep in mind, that Humanity 2.0 is what humanity becomes when understood as the meeting point of social science and social policy, the sort of new reality that's being produced, right? And there's different ways he talks about that. He talks about that as a kind of a combination of sociology and socialism, or more generally, social science and democracy, which is interesting, so that the social policy end of it becomes necessarily democratic, and also, he'll emphasize, rooted in the philosophy of the welfare state. So once we come to think of society as a democratic welfare state, and we come to think of our understanding of that society through social science, then we get this Humanity 2.0 thing emerging. And of course, it's not just social science, or it's maybe social science so broadly understood as to include certain other human sciences, like the biological sciences. And if we understand social science as the kind of critical construction of an ideology for society, right, which wouldn't be difficult for social epistemologists to see, then we really get Humanity 2.0 is what happens when you add biology and ideology. So it's just biology plus ideology. And then there's a big argument. What's biology going to tell us? What's the ideology going to be? And that's going to be the struggle about Humanity 2.0. And certainly, I mean, no matter what your position on this is, that's an interesting conversation to engage in, right? Now, I titled my talk, A Manifest Apathy, because even though there is this immediate sense, and I've tried to make this as interesting as possible, the idea of society understood through social science bores the hell out of me, right? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to say, what is actually an alternative to that way of thinking, right? So what if Humanity 2.0 isn't necessarily what's going to happen, if there's some old school humanity to protect, what does that mean? And what does that mean if we rewind history to the 1920s and ask what else could have happened, right? So there's one of the things we have to realize, the reason to do that is that when we think of humanity through the lens of science, we get this kind of, first of all, this kind of eugenic project. And what that has a tendency to do, as Steve suggests in the book, what that has a tendency to do is to turn the human into a means, not an end. Right? So you abandon the Kantian proposition that humans are always ends in themselves, and you move towards an understanding of humans as having attributes that are interchangeable, modifiable, manipulable, improvable. And then we can have conversations about which improvements do we want, what counts as an improvement, but towards some end of being better as being a human being. And then he says, very interestingly, he says, this could be carbon-based or not. Right? So we could think of ourselves as carbon-based biological organisms, or we could have to transfer our humanity to some, you know, cloud of non-carbon-based being. Now, even that, I want to argue, to think of ourselves as carbon-based and not embodied, which could be a much richer notion than just being carbon-based, right? Even that is quite not quite a modest proposal, I would say. You know, we have to remember that even to say we could defend a position of we must remain carbon-based in these bodies, right? But if we're in these bodies, that could be a much richer thing. And how can it be a richer thing? One of the ways to think of it as richer is certainly to get past something that I think Steve presumes, and he can defend this if he likes, that the distinctively human is going to be cognitive, that we are reasonable beings, right? And that's why we can transfer it into computers, right? Even though we can have a very broad definition of cognition. My argument is that there is no reason to think that we are primarily reasonable beings, right? We are just as equally passionate beings. And this is why I think that there's a good reason to not think of us only in terms of some kind of facticity that we could then decide what can we copy or transmit into some technological version of it. And my basis for that argument actually goes back before 1920 to about 1914, 1913, where Ezra Pound published a very famous essay called The Serious Artist, in which he argued that the arts provide the data for ethics. The arts provide the data for ethics, and what they show us, what a poem, for example, shows us, is how people are different, not how they're the same, right? Not how they are composed of interchangeable parts, like carbon-based DNA structures, that if we do the right technological thing, can be transferred into some future cloud. And then we get from a, yes, 2 minutes, and then we get from a, then we get from a, an idea of understanding of using social science to get knowledge of human beings, even self-knowledge, we might say, but which really becomes kind of a self-knowledge through a study of other people, scientifically, through surveys and so forth, into an idea of self-mastery. And here I would like to remind us of Ezra Pound's very famous poem, The Pizan Cantos, which were written in prison camp after the Second World War, when he was being caught and he was going to be tried for treason, because he took a position that we should not intervene in the fascist experiment. And where he says to himself, we might say, master thyself, then others shall thee bear. Master thyself, then others shall thee bear. And this impotence of poetry is very important. I'm going to need maybe one extra minute.
Sure.
Yes. What happened from the 1920s and onwards is not just that social science became the primary way in which we understand the human, and therefore the basis of this humanity 2.0. What happened was also that poetry was radically marginalized. Right? So where poetry in the 1920s had an enormously important place in how we understand ourselves and who we are, by today, poetry is very, very marginalized, and poets will be the first to tell you this. One of those poets is the one I quoted at the beginning, Ben Lerner, a young poet, very hip, very now, young poet, who said the following in an interview with the Huffington Post. He said, maybe this paradox, how poetry's power in a sense derives from its powerlessness, helps account for the fact that so many people hate poetry, that almost all of our culture's talk about poetry is about its marginality, death, etc. Poetry can make us aware of our capacity to think and feel beyond the merely actual, but it doesn't provide a blueprint for a revolution or environmental stewardship or stewardship or what have you. And that's really, it doesn't provide a blueprint for all these social issues we want to deal with. This can produce serious embarrassment and resentment. People who go around celebrating or lamenting the death of poetry are often really talking about the demise of our capacity to desire alternatives in general. The demise of our capacity to desire alternatives in general. to imagine some other organization of our societal forces, or at least to imagine imagining it instead of just surrendering to the world we've made as if it were a natural, timeless order. And I think that's really where we have to engage with this Humanity 2.0. So, I invite you again to think creatively about politics in the age of histamine. I invite you to think creatively about politics. Given them as they are, asthmatic, out of tune in time, out of bounds in practice, I invite you to run your mouth, to run your hands through my thin heroin theme. I invite you to lean your head against my better judgment. Once uncertainty ran through these sketches like a lab. Now, of my early work, a critic has said, it was open, so I let myself in. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's weather has been canceled. The Academy has condemned the blue tip. The poor are stealing the salt licks. Grenades luxuriate in the garden of decommissioned adjectives. It is the Sabbath. I must invite you to lay down your knowledge claims, to lay them down slowly and with great sadness. Given men as they are, women pack snow into jars for the summer ahead. Given men as they are, the trees surrender. Ben Lerner, the poet, the American poet. Thank you very much. That's it.
So next up we have David Berry from Swansea University.
Humanity 2.0 as what I've sort of rechristened Humanity Plus Plus. Of course, Humanity Plus Plus, any technologist in the audience will recognize that from the notion of sort of C++, i.e. C that got better. And And the idea really is to think about technology and the augmentation of what it is to be human. And in that moment, there's a kind of reconfiguration. Hopefully at some point we'll actually have some slides, because it would be rather helpful.
You would be augmented.
That's right.
Very true.
Radio recited always.
Okay, I can start talking about any of these slides. Okay, so really what I want to start with, I want to sort of contextualize it by talking about the silicon conceit. There we go. I just want to show you this first picture, actually. So beautiful. You can just start to see the outlines of it. And I'm going to come back to this notion of visualizing and seeing. Okay, so first I want to talk about silicon conceit. The silicon conceit, as I see it, is this very strong notion that runs through the kind of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and technologists who really think that the humans are somehow not human enough, as it were. So Google, for example, Schmidt quoted here, we know roughly who you are, roughly what you care about, roughly who your friends are. Google also knows to within a foot roughly where you are. I actually don't think people want Google to answer their questions. They want Google to tell them what they should be doing next. Okay? And this is the next and big wave of technology. And this is kind of driving the way in which technology and the human are being connected together. Google calls this, in a lovely phrase, augmented humanity. And translated, I suppose, this means that Google thinks it knows better than you do what's best for you in terms of what you should do, what you truly want, what you should desire. The idea really is that your past behavior can be computationally collected, and in that collection it can be calculated and predicted in order to offer alternatives to the kinds of things you might have thought you might want to do. So humanity becomes then Humanity Plus Plus. Examples of this, of course, are Google Glass, the new contextual UX stuff, locative technologies, etc. Another way of thinking about this is the notion of anticipatory computing. Computing thinking ahead of us, thinking and providing us with the forethought that we used to, you know, have to labour through ourselves and we used to have to consider our options. This is the idea of the invisible interface, ubiquitous computing, enchanted object, which I think is a very nice way of thinking of it. This provides predictive media and information in real time. This is the notion of real-time streams and real-time media. And it's the reconfiguration, in a certain sense, of what Bernard Stiegler would call secondary memory, such that secondary memory and tertiary memory somehow kind of fuse and become one. Again, some examples, Google Now, Apple Siri, MindMeld, etc. So part of this really, and I'm going to sort of really show quite a few visual examples here because of the limitations on time to go into kind of much detail. The idea that you're going to have to prove your humanity, and proving your humanity as part of this process will be shown certain kind of cognitive ability, certain kinds of uses of these technologies in certain kinds of ways. A good example of this, I think, is the civil rights CAPTCHA here. We all know CAPTCHAs. The very annoying things you have to type in to prove you're not a bot. Well, this one goes a little bit further because you have to actually prove that you take an ethical position on things. And the ethical position is prescribed by the technology. So you probably can't really read it here, but top right there it says, members of the Russian group Pussy Riot were sentenced to 2 years in prison after staging a 41-second long performance in a Moscow church. How does that make you feel? And the options are truly mad, even, and inspired. Right. Now, if you don't make the right choice, you're not human enough. Okay, that's the kind of underlying assumption of this kind of thing. So it's a very fascinating way of reconceptualizing, you know, how we are humans. In a certain sense, it's a gateway, and the gateway is provided by computation. Another example of this is, it's such a shame you can't see the slides. Is it possible to get windows? And this is the notion of computers as witness. This is a wonderful project by the artist Dora Matot. It's called Webcam Tears. And this is where people prove their humanity by crying into a webcam, recording it and uploading it to YouTube or some other social sharing site. The Tumblr, Webcam Tears, is well worth visiting, just for its kind of bizarreness, really, more than anything else. But what I like about it is this notion of proving your humanity, proving your ability to have emotion, right? This is what you're trying to do here. You can sort of see here there are pictures of some people crying recorded on camera. And this is also generated some very interesting projects, again, artist projects, in terms of, you know, how are we still human? You know, how do we draw a distinction between human and non-human? And here, a very interesting project by Adam Harvey, who's done a lot of work in this area, for human eyes only. He actually calls it for your eyes only. The idea being, he asks a question, you know, if Google is computation par excellence, you know, when does Google break down? When does its cognitive abilities to parse visual data break down? So he tries to take photos and work out when Google can no longer recognize it, in order for us to recognize that we are still somehow beyond the computational, beyond this kind of artificial intelligence. And here you see the apple on the right there. Google has no problem recognizing it's an apple. But the apple on the left, by just the application of some stickers on it, suddenly confuses the computational engine. Right? And then we can define ourselves as human again. That's a wonderful thing, of course. This is another project by Adam Harvey, and this is really about how computers are seeing us. And this is a kind of a thread that's going to run continually through this presentation. And what he does is disassembled or reverse engineered facial recognition software. And by running through facial recognition software, these kind of patterns, he's drawn the universal face that computers see. The universal face that you have to match, that is, to be taken to be human again. That's, again, another interesting way of showing the way computers are seeing us. The background to this kind of work, really, and I'm going to step through this really quickly because I haven't got much time, but really the idea is that, you know, understanding digital technology is a hard problem for the humanities and social sciences. We know it's extremely complex, the agentic features, etc., and the normative values, very, very hard to understand. And within my own work, I'm very fascinated by the notion that as computation becomes more and more part of our everyday experience, as it augments us more and more, we notice it less and less. It becomes withdrawn, it becomes backgrounded. So I won't go through that stuff. In my book, The Philosophy of Software, I introduced the notion of computationality. I really haven't got time to go into much detail on this. I really want to show you lots of pictures, basically. So I'm going to step through the philosophical background to the stuff that I talk around, that we can perhaps talk about that in questions. What I want to do is talk about the new aesthetic. The new aesthetic is really fascinating, both for its contestation. I think it's a really interesting kind of contested project. But also it's interesting is in the notion of collecting computer images, shall we say, right? Now what's fascinating is there's an interesting post-human dimension to it. The way in which the project was initially set up, it's been contested now, but it was called Seeing as Machines. And this was really about highlighting the way in which the computation saw us, you know, so our self-definition matters less, and the computational seeing of us is kind of definitional or somehow superior. This was introduced by James Bridle and really rose to prominence after it was presented in South by Southwest. And there it was seen by the famous science fiction writer Bruce Sterling, who wrote on his blog about it and really kind of exploded. Really, it was fascinating giving people a language. So again, I'm not going to talk too much about all the detail of it. What I want to do is start showing you so you can see the new aesthetic. And the new aesthetic really is the digital seeping into everyday life. That's the idea. Or ways of seeing that privilege the computational. So here we see some pixelized cushions. Clearly, cushions aren't made out of pixels. Some good examples here. For example, when we look at Google Earth is seen like a machine. We see pixels now, where previously we might have seen fields. They're actually fields, they're not pixels. And it's not a digital artifact. The fact that we might go online and look for Osama bin Laden's location of his assassination by Obama. That's very fascinating. In fact, it was tweeted in real time. Bottom right, this is interesting. Adam Harvey again, trying to create makeup that prevents computers from recognizing this. This is interesting in the notion of resistance to these computational ways of seeing. Splinter camouflage here, the idea that, you know, it's more dangerous for computers to see the plane than it is for humans. So this attempt to confuse the computational missile systems. Lower a shoe there, taking the shoe and mixing it down. Visualization of a data center. For some reason they thought it was handy to put pixels on the outside to tell us what it was, so this visualization of the digital. And also the digital in everyday life there in New York, a little bit of street art. I'm going to go very quickly now, I'm afraid, just to try and show you all these photos at home. I love this. This is popular culture, representation of the new aesthetic, the censorship towel. This towel's pixelated. Only makes sense if you take digital photos of yourself. Right, so that's very interesting. So once you take a photo, it kind of makes sense. Again, seeing this kind of digital way, thinking digitally, as it were. This is a sculpture by Sean Smith. We think of them as digital. They're actually made out of bits of wood. Again, digital representations, parameterization, where computers are heavily used in the production of the world. What it is to prove you're human, or your location in history, as it were. This interesting Sheikh billionaire, he actually wrote his name 4 miles wide by 2 miles high, just so Google Earth could see it, just so that then when you went on Google Earth, you knew who he was. It's more important to go on Google Earth. These are very interesting visualizations, another interesting artistic project here by Clement Fowler. Google doesn't understand bridges, right? So bridges confuse Google. So it kind of like draws these beautiful images. So if you attempt to set your route to work, it may think that you're going to be going some rather crazy routes. I just think these are really beautiful, interesting way in which algorithms see bridges and try to represent them back to us. Another interesting project by Paolo Cicero. Here, what he does, he goes along the street of Google Street View. We're all familiar with that. Most of you probably used it before you got here. And what he does, he takes photos of people from Street View, prints them out full size, and sticks them back in the location where they were, in some sense mixing the digital and the everyday. Very quickly, I just want to go through the art of Google Books. This is interesting in the fact that Google has had this massive project at somehow collating together all of the knowledge of human beings since, you know, since we began writing, essentially. And I love the glitches that say, you see people's fingers there, more fingers. This is beautiful. This is a thesis in the University of Wisconsin. On the second page, it has the named addresses of the people who read the thesis. Google naturally, computationally, connects it up and then provides us with the Google Maps location and photograph of the people's houses. Even though they took the book out, took the thesis out in 1947, for example. And these are again just some examples of visualization. You know, interesting. You know, for history, I suppose, neon pre-toxins didn't exist in 1897. And over here, it's very interesting. This book from 1700 has hyperlinks, which is Google's attempts to provide hyperlinks into this work. Again, just some more very simple examples I really love. Here, this notion that maps and charts are never seen by Google because they take too much time to open out. And so all they do is they take an image of the closed map. And there's hundreds of these closed maps that are kind of lost because Google never goes back and re-scans these images. And so, you know, it's very fascinating that these charts are nowhere. You know, they're not anywhere. They're located somewhere, but, you know, really we don't see them. And in terms of, you know, the human and the kind of attempt to write yourself in history, there's a lovely selection of marginalia, et cetera, in books that, because Google has scanned, that are available to have a look at and to think through. Wow, that was fast. Okay, so really what I wanted to do is introduce you the notion of the new aesthetic. I wanted to introduce the notion of augmented computation, augmented humanity rather, and the notion of computation as somehow creating something more than humanity, humanity plus plus, or, you know, even just the real humanity. You know, the old human is no longer relevant anymore. What I like about the new aesthetic is it's interesting in really representing or even mediating in some sense the digital. It shows us the digital. Sterling said that the eruption of the digital in the real world, and I think you see the grain of computation, so I think it's a very interesting project. And lastly, I would just like to make a little interesting link between this notion of humanity plus plus that runs through the technologists and, of course, the digital humanities. You know, the question of what the human is runs very deeply through that project. And it's interesting that Alan Liu argues that we should do humanities plus, and I'll just sort of leave that as an interesting issue. And this is a plane taken by Google Earth. Thank you.
So next we have Gregory Sandstrom from Lithuania University of Educational Sciences.
Okay, it's great to be here talking about Humanity 2.0, and I kind of combined two topics here. The first is the biological challenge to the social sciences. This was actually in Steve's earlier book, The New Sociological Imagination. And then on the topic of design and extension of science and technology, and then a couple of sub-themes you can see here on the transhumanism and sort of Hopianism, which I'll go into a little bit as well. But just to start with the outline, I'm going to give a brief background and overview of some of Steve's recent works, 2005-2012. Then about design and intelligent design, definitions basically. Then specifically on to Humanity 2.0 and some themes throughout the work and some questions that maybe can be brought up later. And then I use this term paractionary cornucopianism, which is something that Steve talks about, paractionary, and I combine that with a cornucopian view, and then design, human extension, and development, and then some concluding thoughts. So I'll try to get through quite a bit of material here in a short amount of time. So Steve's work and how I came into contact with it, Science, Ideology, and Worldview. Steve's written several books on science, religion, on intelligent design, which have been quite controversial, after earlier work on the social epistemology. I was working in Russia at the Academy of Sciences in the area of sociology of science and science and technology studies, nauka videnie in Russian, science studies, and that's how I came into contact with Steve. And then this intelligent design movement. Steve was in the trial, the Dover trial in Pennsylvania in 2005, and I thought, there's a sociologist doing work on intelligent design. This is something unusual. Mainly it's biologists and information theorists, and there's a lot of controversy around it and whatnot. And I think he brings a very interesting perspective to this in the discussion of the academic spheres and the dialogue between the different realms, humanities, social sciences, natural sciences, and whatnot. And I was really just fascinated. One of my academic mentors, so to speak, is Marshall McLuhan. And he talks here about the phrase, the extensions of man,
humanity, the technological simulation of consciousness. And that seems to echo with the theme of this book, Humanity 2.0. And both provocative and as McLuhan likes to talk about writing with probes, probing people, probing. I don't explain, I explore. And I see a lot of that in Steve's work as well. He did a tweet, I don't know how you call it, a Twitter project on the Christmas last year, the 25th.
A Twitter lecture.
A Twitter lecture.
25 tweets, a lecture.
25 tweets on the topic, how to think like God. And here he said in that lecture, for reality to be intelligible, as science presupposes, it must exist so so our minds can fathom it. We must think like its creator. And this is a thread that runs throughout the book Humanity 2.0 as a challenge. It overlaps with intelligent design, but I think in a different way. And one of the things for me when reading Steve's books, I put up there challenging discomfort. He raises a lot of really sticky topics, a lot of topics that really make you question. Thomas brought up the issue of the Nazi science, science and religion, eugenics, race, these so-called two taboos. Race and religion in science, difficult to grapple with. Justified or justifiable suffering, bioprospecting, and does the divine reside within us or not? Is that a feature of humanity that we need to discuss? Theodicy, the problem of evil. So these are a lot of really challenging topics that he raises, and I find it very fascinating to explore it in various ways. He puts things there that you can take and run with, as the two presentations already have done here today. So onto this design and intelligent design, I just wanted to throw out there at the beginning, can we get design without intelligence? This is not an intelligent design conference, and I was going to talk more about that, but design seems to require intelligence in the way that we're talking about here in terms of human-made design. So all human-made things are designed and or extended from at least a degree or kind of human intelligence. The degree-kind distinction is quite important to make, and it also runs throughout Steve's work, but this notion of human intelligence being something specific that we can talk about. Well, but what about non-human made things? This is the intelligent design focus, like ecology or the biosphere, and then they include origins of life or origins of biological information. A recent book has come out. Steve uses the phrase divine technology. Can we speak of those things as being designed as well? Or is that a different category or category error of this term design? The intelligent design movement says this is the right term to use in biology. A quotation from Michael Behe, one of the leaders of the intelligent design movement, he says design is simply the purposeful arrangement of parts. And it could be from a transcendent or a mundane designer, but they don't talk about who is the designer. This one from an artist, although there are not a lot of artists that seem to be using the phrase intelligent design specifically, but this is Jody Sobrin who painted this this image in the top right-hand corner, the eagle into the plane. She says, with art, architecture, and engineering, the main issue here is that mind precedes matter. So we have a reverse perspective. Matter precedes mind, or mind precedes matter. That, for her, is the essence of intelligent design. But of course, it's different to look at design artistically than to look at it and say, this is a concept that belongs in biology. So giving some more definitions that I think are closer to this event, perhaps, is some people that have been called design theorists that are not intelligent design thinkers. Herbert Simon, Science is the Artificial, he talks about changing existing conditions into preferred ones. Horst Riddle, another design theorist, designs an activity aimed at producing a plan. It's intended somehow. Bela Banathy, a Hungarian systems thinker, he says design is a journey of creation. And you can see how this overlaps. Why would the intelligent design movement use this conceptual pairing of design that is intelligent? Because for them, it has been called the new creationism. But this is different with Banathy. Nigel Cross from the UK talks about human intelligence, design thinking as a way to understand ourselves. The intelligent design doesn't talk about design processes,
like we've been discussing here at this event. And in Steve's work in Humanity 2.0, he says the failure of intelligent design theory to specify the intelligent designer constitutes a rhetorical and epistemological disadvantage. So the fact that they're not willing to say, yes, we believe the designer is aliens, or
God.
Do people know this? I mean, it's expected, but they say that's not part of the theory. And interestingly, in Humanity 2.0, in the final chapter, there's no mention of intelligent design. So I think in some cases, Steve's been given inappropriately some kind of reputation as being one of those intelligent design people, whereas I think his approach to the topic does distinguish itself quite differently from their work, and opens a lot of new fascinating topics that I don't think they're working on based in Seattle in the United States. So Humanity 2.0, some of the themes, interesting, this notion of enhancement, which is also present in Marshall McLuhan. He says the enhancement of human performance, that's the US model, and improving human welfare, that's the EU model, the proactionary and the precautionary. The challenge of dehumanization, and this topic really fascinated me and still does, have we become less human? Or can we become more human, and what does that involve? And he offers a positive view, an enchanted view, if we go back to Weber. How do we become re-enchanted? How can Humanity 2.0 be enchanted or enchanting rather than disenchanted and dehumanized or casualized, as he says sometimes? Physics and biology-based sociodicy, the problem of evil in society, it doesn't deal with the individual as an autonomous agent. And so he's suggesting we need to humanize by looking at the individual autonomous agent. The biological challenge to the social sciences, this term really is a descriptive zoocentric misanthropy. There's a problem when we talk to ethologists rather than anthropologists. There's a different conception of human beings if we talk about human beings as animals and not as higher rational beings. Science education as a way of knowing and being, something like mode 3 knowledge, and it being an important feature of society, this sociology of science technology studies, like the Dutch Fleischberg, I don't know how to say it properly, phrenetic social science, applied wisdom. And also there's he's supportive of a dialogue, a cooperative or collaborative dialogue between these major realms, being science, natural and social, philosophy and worldview, that connects with converging technologies. Still a few more themes and a couple of questions. He says we have options. We can try to conform to some kind of divine plan, or we can decide to take nature's incompleteness and we can try to complete nature. And this is with the prosthetics and enhancements and part of this notion of humanity rising to a higher level. This is the transhumanist project, which he refers to as reflexive evolution, a process where we can ethically regulate genetic experimentation. We can steer the course of biological evolution. He says we must be able and allowed to choose to be part of the divine scheme as if we had a hand in the design. So there were co-creators or something like this. We have a hand in the design. Well, then the question to me is this: how is a person supposed to rethink God's thoughts if he or she is an atheist? Are we imagining ourselves as gods? We're the instruments that create divine technology. And also he raises the topic of the Übermensch, the Superman, the Superwoman, which is this enhanced version of humanity, something higher. But what is this? Is it biotechnological therapies that offer this, or something else that enables us to move to a higher level, to reimagine our humanity? And I wanted to bring this image. This is from Mexico City, actually, where Melissa is based. It's a mosaic on a building outside. And for me, it's an interesting sort of historical overview. You can see on the bottom left corner, primitive humanity, no fruit in the trees, we have the animal there. And then fire, the discovery of fire, and the fire is passed on. And we get to this civilizing process, and then we get this blue light.
And what that's the discovery of energy, the mosaic is called the conquest of energy. But that knocks us down. Humanity has fallen by the power of the technologies that we've created. And then the last part, and maybe this is sort of provocative on the humanity 2.0, there's something new. There's fruit on the tree again, and humanity has been lifted up. There's kind of an angelic figure there. There's some flying. There's a new direction or a new possibility. And it seems to me that's what we face here with the design and science and technology. Again, this process, if we're in an evolutionary process, where does it end? Or what's the next step? Are we turning into a robotic, a silicon-based creatures? Cornucopianism, I don't have a lot of time here, but the freedom to innovate technologically, this is by Max Moore. Evolution now exemplifies the modern scientific worldview. So we have this process where we're evolving technologically, but there's a challenge to this, and Steve's work also challenges the notion of Darwinianism as an ideology. So this is Theodosius Dobzhansky, one of the founders of the modern synthesis. He says Darwin's theory was good biology, which was perverted by others to support bad sociology. If that's the case, when we're talking about design, design science and anticipating the future, do we need to use evolutionary language? And that's what I'm going to get to in the next stage. But this cornucopianism is the opposite of the doom scenario. The doom scenario, that we cannot be hopeful, we have to have despair because of the problems of science and technology. Steve says we can cultivate hope and anticipation of our actions, that what ought to be done may well be doable. So there's some kind of hopefulness here that's really important. Enhancing performance, prosthetics, life extension, and that's where I'm going to transition to the next slide. This is something that I've been working on through with Marsha McLuhan, and the notion of extending. Rather than evolving, we don't choose to evolve because that requires a telos, a direction to which we would like to go. We need to think things out before we put them out. All human artifacts are extensions of mankind. So rather than just saying we have technologies that are evolving all around us, we don't have any choices, the environmental pressure, there's some kind of technological determinism. No, McLuhan is saying our artifacts are extensions. And this connects with this notion of the technology, the divine technology. The evolutionary process shifted at Sputnik from biology to technology. So we're in a different world now. We're in the Holocene. We're in a humanitarian discussion rather than a discussion of biology and genetics. And then just to close with this notion of the transhuman and to put a couple questions that may go into the discussion. Does the transhumanist imperative mean to re-engineer the human body for life extension and or for moral entrepreneurism, which is also a topic Steve talks about in Humanity 2.0, which I found really fascinating? He says the prophetic religions are future-oriented, so I wanted to ask if are the prophetic religions transhuman-oriented? Is that a connection that can be made? Lastly, the revival of theodicy. I put up here an image of the Terminator and from the second Terminator at the very end of the film. He says, I cannot self-terminate. Here, you must do it for me. In the third film, Schwarzenegger says to John Connor, you cannot self-terminate. And John Connor says, I'm a human being. I'm not some goddamn robot. I can do anything I want. In other words, there's something here in humanity that isn't present in the machines, in the robots. And then finally, just to close with this, Auguste Comte's three-stage theory, have you effectively dismantled this notion? Do we live in an age now of science, philosophy, and worldview or theology? Do we need to come back and say, Auguste Comte had this view, now we can't hold it any longer? And the notion of humanity 2.0 or the divine humanity, is that something we can say now we've moved beyond Auguste Comte to the new time? And that's all. Thank you very much.
And then now we have Sarah Chan from Manchester University.
So the good thing about going last is that the topic's already been introduced for me. The bad thing about going last is I somehow need to take on board all of the very interesting things that have been said by the speakers before me and try and incorporate them into my discussion. So I'm going to try and do that. I thought Thomas opening with the quote from Ben Lerner about given men as they are is a very apt way to frame our discussion for this session, because we might think about given men as they are, but of course we're not constrained to stay as we are. In fact, I think as David's presentation showed, we're going to have great difficulty either staying who we are or knowing who we are in an ever-changing and increasingly technologized world. So we have on the one hand this given men as they are, but then we also have this idea about things as they ought to be. So around about the start of the 20th century, someone invented a little sort of mannequin figure who was called Billiken, the god of things as they ought to be. And this is this, if you go to Japan, you'll still see little shrines to the god of things as they ought to be all around the place. How are things as they ought to be? This is the question that's really at the heart of our thinking about humanity in the future. How ought we to be? So as Greg said, what's the next step? Where are we going and where ought we to be going? Ought we, for example, as Thomas discussed, ought we to remain carbon-based? Ought we to remain human? What does that even mean? There's this dichotomy between things as they are versus things as they ought to be. But the question we also need to be asking is, who decides the ought? Who decides what is important about how we are that should shape how we ought to be? Who tells us? Is it who ought to tell us? To whom do we look to tell us? So what I want to do in this presentation is firstly to address one particular class of ought, or rather ought not arguments, to do with what we might call post-human enhancement. So Greg brought up explicitly this idea of enhancement and transhumanism as a way of improving the species or making us better. And we're going to come back to this idea of what does it mean to improve, to what are we going to, what means better. So the arguments that I want to address are ones that focus particularly on preserving the human species. And what I'm going to say is that those sorts of concerns don't provide good grounds to constrain our use of the different types of technologies that are available and that are going to become available to us. But then what I want to do is to open up, hopefully for our discussion later on, what I think are perhaps even more interesting questions about what's driving, if we are evolving towards some sort of post-human future, what's driving that? What pressures are shaping our, whether you want to call it evolution or design, what shapes that and how do those forces also shape our choices as to how technology is used? And I want to suggest another way to look at the prospect of what we might call post-human enhancement that takes society rather than species as its object. So the species-based, or you might call it the speciesist objection to using enhancement technologies is basically that they will change us so much, both individually and as a society, that we will somehow no longer be human. So the post-human state in most critical writings is defined by its distinctness, its differentness from the human state. So if you consider the way Cook defines post-humanness, a post-human would no longer be a human being, having been so significantly altered as to no longer represent the human species. Nick Bostrom, one of the proponents of transhuman or post-human enhancement, describe post-humans as being beings with vastly greater capacities than present human beings. And this is often used as an objection to these kinds of technologies. So we shouldn't use, whether it be genetic enhancement, some form of biotechnology or cyber enhancement, digital computing, we shouldn't use these because they would make us something other than human, they would make us beings who would not be like us at all. These technologies pose a threat to our common humanity, or it will cause us in some ways to lose our humanity. So these are the sorts of things that the critics are saying about what we might call post-human enhancement. Now there's a fundamental sort of assumption that lies at the heart of this. If you look at the language that they're using here, it's very much a language of exclusion. It sets up an us and a them. So us is the humans, and them is all the non-humans, including post-humans, non-human animals, computers, possible artificial intelligence, and so forth. Consider this quote from Nick Agar about radical enhancement and post-humanism. He says, it threatens to turn us into fundamentally different kinds of beings, so different that we will no longer deserve to be called human. It will make us post-human. So look at the language here. It's an inherently value-laden description. Why should becoming something other than human be regarded as a threat? Sorry about my underlinings in a very good place. But why should that be considered a threat? And why is being called human some sort of accolade that needs to be deserved? The underlying assumption in all of these critiques of post-human enhancement is that being human, being Homo sapiens, is the best species for us to be. So we, whoever we are, should prize our humanity and strive to retain it. But I think that poses two very important questions to us. What is valuable about being human? What is actually important about humanity? And what would be wrong with being or becoming a different species? There are two ways in which we might look at the possibility of becoming post-human. The first is just simply through a gradual process of social and biological change. Again, we can argue about whether we call this evolution, but it's undoubtable that the human race, human society, the human species, if you want to call us that, has undergone a great deal of change even in the last few centuries. So our lives are greatly enhanced compared to human beings living even as recently as a century ago. We have greater capacities, we live longer, our health is generally better. And that's a process that has happened partly through the effects of biological change and the change in the human gene pool, but also through the use of technology. So there's no reason to suppose that that sort of process won't continue in future. People may say, well, we shouldn't meddle with natural evolution, we shouldn't try and direct it, but the fact is, as I'm sure you're all aware, we already do. So if we view it in this way, the process of post-human evolution or changing to post-humans has already begun. So it's a continuum that connects our present-day humans with our human ancestors, our pre-human ancestors, early hominids, even beyond that, our common ape ancestors, with the kinds of beings who might be our descendants in the future. The other way in which we might see some sort of transition to the post-human state occur is by some sort of rapid transformation through the radical use of technology. Let's say this transformation might happen rather than by a process of incremental change over a long time, instantaneously, or at least within a single lifetime. I'm going to come back to consider that possibility a bit later, but I want to dissect some of the assumptions and some of the moral thinking that underlies the critiques that we just looked at of post-human enhancement. So this question about what's special about being human is really a common thread that runs through the whole discourse about the possible futures of humanity, whether we call it humanity 2.0, humanity plus plus, or something else. Excuse me. It's a concern that underpins our thinking about the ways in which humans live in the digital age, in the biotechnological age, and it's a concern to distinguish ourselves somehow, to say, well, what is it that makes us both special and different to other kinds of creatures, or for that matter, from computers and search engines and so forth. The use of biological species as a moral divide, not only to tell us who we are, but also who we should be, is problematic for a number of reasons. First of all, the species concept itself, as you know, is a social construct. It's a biological category, its boundaries are fluid, there are many different definitions. How would we tell a post-human from a human on that sort of biological species basis? At the moment, it's pretty easy to distinguish members of our biological species from other species, just because we're fortunate enough, or perhaps unfortunate enough, not to have any species so closely related to us that we would get confused. But, of course, with the kind of post-human that we might create, that's not going to be the case. So one characteristic that's often used to determine whether individuals belong to the same species is whether they are interfertile, whether they can interbreed. So you might say, well, if we're going to tell ourselves from the post-humans, we'll have to subject everybody to forced reproduction to see if you produce viable offspring or not. Then we'd know whether you're our species and we'd be able to tell whether you count. So clearly that's an entertaining speculation, but the deep question here is not just how we define ourselves as the human species in biological terms, but more fundamentally why it matters. So what's important about being human as opposed to being another species? Attempts to define what is special about being human or unique about humans are often phrased in terms of human nature or human dignity. So take, for example, Francis Fukuyama's search for factor X, which he considers to be an essential human quality. So he says, Factor X not only purports to define what's unique about humans, but is defined by its uniqueness to human beings. It's all these qualities coming together in a human whole which make up Factor X. In other words, if these qualities were to come together in some other form, they wouldn't serve as the basis for entitlement to the higher moral status that is supposedly, according to Foucault, possessed by humans, on the sole grounds that their possessor was not human. So if there was a creature that met all of these requirements save for being not in a human whole, we wouldn't regard that creature as being of the same moral status. Now, clearly, if and while this sort of speciesism holds sway, it's better to be human than to be anything else. It's better to be human than to be a non-human primate. It's better to be a human than a post-human. But that's kind of like saying it's better to be white in a racist world, or it's better to be male in a sexist world. Under certain circumstances, clearly it's better to choose to be one form than another, but we shouldn't say on that basis we shouldn't create post-humans because we are speciesist. We actually should say that we ought to adopt a less speciesist view of moral status and what counts. Let's think about that second possibility that I mentioned, that post-humans might arise not gradually but rapidly as the result of the application of some sort of technological miracle. And this might be either something that we apply to ourselves, so beings who currently exist, or for our children, future beings. Why might we want to reject this? Well, Nick Agar has proposed this theory of what he calls species relative value, according to which humans stand to lose much of what it is we value by becoming post-human. So if we were to apply these technologies to ourselves, we would somehow lose something. He posits that there are certain shared experiences and values that are essentially human. So although he doesn't valorize being human as objectively better, he says that because we are human, it is subjectively better for us to stay that way because we share these things. And he says these are experiences and values typical of the ways in which humans live and love. They are consequences of the psychological commonalities that make humans a single biological species. And he argues that becoming post-human would mean or might mean sacrificing these, and therefore it would be the prudential choice for us to say, no thanks, we'll stay human. But there are a lot of problems with this account. First of all, imputing biological species membership and psychological commonality seems to be the wrong way around. I think we would more likely say that if we found other creatures who were biologically much like us and they had common psychological attributes, we might not accord them membership of our biological species, but we would hopefully consider them members of our moral species. A deeper problem, however, is whether we really share fundamental valued experiences that are essentially and uniquely human. So for every kind of preference that you think a human might have, we can think of other people who might hold an opposite preference. Most humans like chocolate, some do not. Even for more fundamental, you know, that's a facile example, but even for the kinds of fundamental experiences that Agar and others who are against post-human enhancement talk about, I've given you some examples there. I think the more we probe into this, the more we see that these are not necessarily values that are shared by all. They may be shared by most. They are species typical, but they are not species definitive. I don't think we would say that somebody who has reached the age of 65 and doesn't have mature interests, has had a series of definitely short love affairs, isn't concerned with natural procreation or any of those things. We would not say this person is not a member of the human species. So really this is a statement about personal preferences. If you happen to share these preferences, that's fine. Don't use enhancement technologies. If not, maybe post-humanism is for you. Here's where we get, though, to a problem of identity. So one of the concerns about using these technologies, if we were, say, to upload ourselves into computers, if we were to radically change our form, it's not just a question of we as a species, whether we would still be us, but whether I as the individual would still be me. Now, that's a problem that's been discussed at length in the philosophical literature, and I don't want to go into it here, but I want to broaden that question out and look at the problem of species identity. Are values and experiences and abilities really what defines our identity, either in a personal sense or as a species? Deaf children can be given cochlear implants to make them hear, but that doesn't change their identity. They were not members of another species before they had those and become human when they acquire an ability that's common to most of us. I won't go into my other two examples because I think the point is fairly clear. Hearing's a natural human ability, but why should that make any difference? If we suddenly discovered a tribe of humans with UV vision, would we decide that UV vision had become an essentially human characteristic, or would we declare them to be post-humans? The first post-human abilities, experiences, and so forth that we have as a result of technologies will be had by humans, and they will therefore, the possessors of these experiences will be human. In other words, post-humans are us. We have found the post-humans, and they are us. Neither can we show that it's wrong to create post-human children. While we might say that the kind of relationships we might have with human children rather than post-human children would be closer or better because we have shared experience, that presumes that we value the shared experience we have with our children more than we value our children having perhaps an objectively better life, and I'm coming to this objectively better to open up the discussion in a moment. Again, it's a personal preference. I might prefer that, for example, if I have some sort of what you might call a disability, I might prefer that my children not have that, even though we won't share the experience, and that they have a better life. I thought I had some more slides, but clearly not. Yeah, it's actually perfect time. Can I just raise the last two questions to start the discussion? So, the slides that I thought I had and have miraculously disappeared are about shaping the post-human future. And I said at the start that I wanted to raise the question of who shapes the ideals for us, who decides. Arguments about enhancement, about the use of new technologies, I would suggest to you are not arguments necessarily about whether we can or should be using technology to move ourselves closer to our ideals, to improve the human condition, because why wouldn't we? We've always been doing this. They're actually arguments about who defines the ideal, what constitutes an improvement. And I want to suggest that we need to be very conscious of the ways in which our choices to use or not to use technology are shaped by ideals that may not be our own. Take the normativity of medicine, for example, the fact that enhancement technologies, at least in the medical sphere, are often available through healthcare, that means that we are permitted to use them for reasons that are considered to be health-promoting, not permitted for other reasons. So there's a huge sort of hidden normativity there that I think needs to be unpicked and discussed. I want to suggest, actually, that the single most important feature of an ideal post-human society, the humanity 2.0 that we ought to be pursuing, is not that we all share the same interests or the same values or the same form or the same state of being, the same state of perfect health, if we want to call it that. What's most important is that everyone is enabled as much as possible and as justly as possible, not only to pursue but also to define their own ideals. So several years ago I published a paper in which I said that enhancement was anything that promoted human flourishing. And I would like to revise that definition. Enhancement is anything that improves not human flourishing in general, because as I've just shown, what does human mean? Enhancement is something that improves the individual flourishing of beings as members of society. And I think that's a good point to leave it. Thanks.
Thank you. We have Steve providing responses for.
So you crack a sharp whip, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, first thing I want to say is I want to thank Francis for organizing this session, and also for the speakers, all of whom are individually very interesting people, whose work you should be following up, regardless of what you think of what they have to say about Humanity 2.0. And I'm very happy to be associated with all of them, okay? The first point I want to make, and maybe for those of you who know my work in social epistemology, why have I ended up here talking about Humanity 2.0? And I want to just begin by saying a little bit about that. And I think it comes out a lot in the talks with regard to the issue of normativity. Because those of you who know about my earlier work know that that social epistemology, for me, is about how knowledge ought to be produced and distributed. And very much in the foreground of my thinking about it has always been, what are the ends of knowledge? Okay, what is knowledge for? And for whom is knowledge? And in a sense, this is one aspect of my approach to social epistemology that distinguishes me from other people who call themselves epistemologists. I'm actually concerned about the value, the ends question. I've always been concerned with that. But ultimately, that's a question about what sort of a world we want to live in and what sort of people we want to be. And I would just make as a kind of historian, so it's quite natural to think, you know, if you follow that out to its conclusion and you take the idea of the ends of knowledge seriously, that you're going to be forced to deal with the issue of who are we, what are we for, what are we about, and especially in a time when there are all these possibilities that are opening up to us, both, you might say, at the scientific end and the technological end. And what I mean by at the scientific end is, in a sense, the issues that revolve around the distinctiveness of human beings as a species, right? Because there is this increasing identification that is largely science-based with us, with other animals. And so those of you, the easiest way to make the point, and in a sense I think it's been alluded to but in several of the other papers, is in terms of the idea of the sort of Peter Singer line, where the threshold of moral salience is sentience, right? So the fact that if you're a moral being, a being that should be considered as part of the social community, whose concern we should be directed toward, right? Sentience, not cognition, is the main characteristic. But on the other hand, we have this kind of technological drive, which is coming through the computer-based technology, and I think David's talk, in a way, was the most straightforward on that issue, where, in a sense, we're talking about the possibility that the carbon-based existence, our normal animal way of being, is just a way station to some other kind of existence, which would, in fact, enable us to be what we would like to be better than we currently are. Okay, so we've got these kind of two pulls there, and these things, in a way, constitute two different ends for knowledge that are based on two different kinds of ends of the kind of world in which we would like to live. And Humanity 2.0, you might say, is about reaching that decision point. And I think it's just worth pointing out as a historical idea that in the term epistemology in the English language, when it was first introduced in the mid-19th century, was brought in from the German idealist tradition, and it was about human self-realization, okay? And that, as it were, the more that we know about the world, the more we come to a greater understanding of who we are in this world, okay? And I think that, in a sense, the Humanity 2.0 project is very much, very much in the spirit of that original sense of epistemology, which isn't necessarily the more kind of academic sense of epistemology that's practiced in philosophy departments today. All right. So I do think that there's a kind of a natural progression there. One of the things that I would say, I think it's been alluded to by several of the speakers, that I tend to, you might say, have a kind of liberal attitude toward Humanity 2.0. In other words, I'm willing to explore all kinds of possibilities, including quite radical possibilities, about where we may go from here. And here, I think, in thinking about this matter, I draw a very sharp distinction, perhaps sharper than normally is drawn in the literature, between the transhuman and the posthuman. So in a sense, you might say Humanity 2.0 can be transhuman or posthuman. And by transhuman, I basically mean taking the things that we value most about human beings in their current form and extending them indefinitely. And this is where sort of the things that Greg is talking about comes in whatever medium it takes. So if it takes computers, if it takes extensions where we're somehow cyborgized, that's fine. It doesn't have to necessarily remain within the sort of Darwinian Homo sapiens. And that's transhumanism, and that's where, if you think about people like Ray Kurzweil, who has this very radical view of uploading consciousness and so forth and extending it indefinitely in a medium that allows it to be extended much more than we can through our carbon-based bodies, that is transhumanism. And the original use of the word transhumanism comes from Julian Huxley, and it was about a kind of eugenics project, which was this reflexive evolution thing that was referred to by one of the speakers. Namely, we re-engineer and upgrade our own bodies. And we may even upgrade it to something more, which is what the kind of technological extension idea is. That's transhumanism. The interesting thing about transhumanism is it's very strongly grounded on human values, human-based values, but basically saying that we, the physical embodiments that we currently have, may not be the best ways to express or extend them. And I connect this with a very strong theological impulse, namely the fallen state of the body, right? And I think the transhuman, no matter what they officially call themselves, atheists or otherwise, that transhumanist, it doesn't really make sense as a proposition unless there's a theological backdrop, where there's some sense in which the body as normally constituted, as normally given to us by evolution, is in some sense fallen, and that we can do better, okay? And that we can go beyond it, and we can transcend it. And that's why it's interesting, one of the first books to do a kind of survey of the various transhumanist movements as they were emerging in the 1990s was called Technosis, right? Referring to Gnosticism, that sort of heretical sect of Christianity, which basically curses the body. Okay? And I think so transhumanism, in a sense, is about, you know, taking us away from what's holding us back. Posthumanism is a different proposition. Posthumanism, as was alluded to, doesn't privilege the human. And this is where we go back to Peter Singer and the animal liberation and all that other thing. Where, in a sense, that human beings fetishize their own existence. That they place unnecessary value on the things that distinguish us from other things. So what if we have, you know, a greater cerebral cortex that enables us to do more computations than other creatures? Big deal. Why is that important? That's just an accident of evolution. Why should we fetishize that and extend it indefinitely? After all, it may end up just destroying the environment and getting rid of everybody. Right, so the post-human condition is a totally different ballgame. It's one that, in a sense, perhaps puts a value on life, but doesn't necessarily put a special value on human life. Okay, and those are really, and so when you look at the arguments of where do we go on from humanity 1.0 to humanity 2.0, the two options are kind of to amplify the human in some way, or in some sense to say that we've been fetishizing the human too much, and that we need to level the ontological playing field. Those are two quite different futures, okay? And they both are coming out of humanity 2.0, and they have all kinds of very interesting consequences. Now, here's the story, here's the problem. The problem is, supposing we live in a liberal democratic society where we're allowing both of those options to develop. How do they coexist? Because in a liberal democratic society, if you go back to John Locke in the 17th century, where we get our sort of classic notions of human rights and civil rights and things like that, one of the presuppositions is all men are created equal. And that was meant to be at a physical level, right? And that was holding what was the source of all the differences between people in real societies were forms of discrimination that were not legitimate. Right? Race, gender, class, you name it, still with us today. But the point was, if you removed those things, there was a kind of natural equality among humans as Homo sapiens. And sure, there were differences in terms of the kinds of functions that people perform in society, but they were complementary. And that's why the whole idea of a division of labor made so much intuitive sense in the 17th and 18th century when we start to get the founding of social science. Okay? But that is predicated on the idea that human beings, biologically speaking, are roughly equal. You know, all things considered. And once we get rid of all of the discrimination and all the prejudice, and we get rid of all the centuries of biases and so forth, we have equal natural humans. This is a very constant view among the liberal and socialist tradition, certainly in the modern period. That is disappearing in this world we're talking about. That's the problem, right? How do you have a liberal society in which we are allowing people to move in these two radically different directions, where in a sense what both sides in a sense agree on is that liberal individual conception of equal human bodies is the ground, is taken as given. That is no longer taken as given. So how do we constitute a liberal society on the basis of this? I think this is going to be a real challenge, politically, ethically, and so forth. And in a sense, we're just beginning to come to terms with this. I think at the moment, and you know, this 4S is a great example of how this stuff gets played out. Everybody likes to play with this stuff because, ooh, it's kind of radical, non-humans, you know. We're talking about turning into monsters or zombies or something. But actually, look at this as a concrete normative proposition where you're organizing your world. What does this look like? For example, what does your national health system look like? Okay, so for example, in a post-human national health system, you might actually want to say some animals are included because they're the significant others to humans who are paying the taxes, rather than other human beings who aren't the significant others to anyone. Right? In terms of what as matters of concern, this is a concrete way in which this would be actualized on the political agenda. Or maybe people who have android companions, which are increasingly built and fashionable to have, you know, with elderly people and so forth, who are in fact their significant others. Those people may want to have a larger percent of the medical research budget put into mechanical engineering or electronic engineering. Because they want to have those androids upgraded and made, as it were, more human-like, more responsive to their needs. And they're more concerned about that than traditional medical care. You see, there are all kinds of areas that are opening up here that have all kinds of normative implications with how we organize our social and political life. And it's going to be very difficult to have a world where all those things can live together. But at the moment, we're exploring them all. And it's true that most of them, you might say, are kind of not within the political horizon, you know, for the next generation or so. But they're coming on stream, and people, as it were, are, as it were, acting as if they're real possibilities, or writing about it more. You know, in the science studies literature, we have this thing called anticipatory governance. You may have run across this. There's a chapter in the last handbook about this. And this is a great STS boom industry, where you get STS people funded by science policymakers, both in Europe and the United States, right, basically providing scenarios of all kinds of new innovations coming on stream. How would you think about these things? How would you relate to them? Right, in other words, softening people up that this new future is on the horizon without necessarily taking into account what are going to be the normative problems in terms of turning this into a serious political proposition once it does come on stream. Okay, and I do think that this is, in a sense, you know, those of you who are concerned about the social epistemology project and that, you know, we want knowledge for living in the kind of world in which we would like to live, we have to realize that we are allowing a full range of possibilities to coexist at the moment, and whether they can coexist indefinitely, especially once they become more fully realized, is the big question. And I think all of these speakers that we've seen this morning, in a way, are hinting around this. And I would just say, by conclusion, you know, when David was talking about this idea of, you know, having the computers being able to determine who's a human being, you know, I started thinking we're going to have demarcation criteria for humanity, right? I mean, just like demarcation criteria for science, a la Karl Popper and so forth, where the idea is you set up a crucial experiment, and so it doesn't matter what your theories say. Your theories can have all kinds of metaphysical commitments and all kinds of fancy intellectual things going on, but if you don't pass that crucial experiment, you're not a scientific theory. Well, similarly with the human being, right? A human being can have a lot of stuff going on, but if they can't do that CAPTCHA thing, right, they don't pass, okay? And you see, I think those kinds of examples are really very good to focus our minds, because we're not, you know, we're entering into a period where we're exploring a lot of different possibilities coming out of humanity 1.0, but at the end of the day, there are going to be some boundary conditions put in, some boundaries of what's in and what's out. And in a sense, this kind of CAPTCHA model that David was talking about is the beginning of a kind of high-tech version of that. And I think, you know, in a sense, we should be ahead of the curve on this, that what does the boundaries of the new society look like? What do the norms look like? What do the terms of governance look like? Can we talk about participatory democracy in a world where people might be so radically embodied in the way that we're imagining at the moment? And so I would just say one final thing. For those of you especially who came in late, this afternoon, we are going to be pursuing, we only have a few minutes now for discussion, but this afternoon there are two sessions devoted to social epistemology starting at 2 o'clock, and we will be re-raising all of these issues that have come today, so I hope that many, if not most of you, can show up for that, because I don't expect that in the next 10 minutes or so we'll be able to deal with all the issues. Thank you very much.
Point, the sessions are actually in this room, so if you come back at 2 o'clock, we'll be here. So, questions?
I have a question about the normativity of human rights. Because it seems to me normativity, to some extent, depends on the nature of the problem. Who's able to act is the question of who is able to do politics. And so these post-human and trans-human futures not only offer different notions of the human, but also potentially also different notions of what normativity would be.
Yes.
So in the post-human, as I understand it, normativity is not no longer the property of the human, precisely because in humanity 1.0, too much credit was given to the human as being an actor who was able to act normatively. So I wonder whether this question of normativity, I mean, the way that you use it seems to be quite sort of universal throughout these different states of humanity. I just wonder whether it needs to be qualified.
Well, see, when I say normativity, what I mean is kind of the rules by which we ought to govern society, where there's an open question as to who should be in it, right? So, for example, if we actually have a real post-human society, one that actually, I would say, let's say we took animals seriously as actually having rights and to whom we have duties and vice versa, right? In the first instance, I suppose one would have
active representation for animals. So the whole legal sphere of animal rights legislation and so forth would open up more, and we would start to, as it were, incorporate animals into our considerations of our welfare functions. And this is where the national health example comes in. But in a sense, my basic notion of normativity is fairly neutral. You see, it's basically about what are the rules by which we should govern ourselves, keeping in mind what is the kind of world in which we would like to live, right? And I think a world where you give relative equality to animals, you know, humans and other animals, is one where you put a lot of stress on, for example, the avoidance of suffering, the avoidance of pain, the kind of thing that is in fact a negative that is common to all of those species. Because if you actually look at, from the standpoint of the history of ethics, let's say, the value placed on suffering is variable, because there are some theories of ethics where in fact suffering is a means to an end. Right? It is not necessarily a bad in itself. But of course it would be a bad in itself if sentience is the primary level at which life is being registered. You see, so I'm keeping the notion of normativity open with regard to a lot of these very important questions, but what's common to it is the fact that we put a boundary at the end of who's in and who's out. You see, I mean, it is kind of a legal notion in that respect. And I think, you know, in the postmodern condition, people have been allergic to do that. Right? People want to say all the boundaries are broken, everything's open, blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't actually believe that. I actually think that there is a sense in which there are boundaries, and in a sense, they're being implicitly made by the kinds of choices people are being made now, but at some point, there will be a kind of larger scale political, legal discussion about this.
Yes. I'd like to raise two problems that for me one is about the possibility of anticipatory governance, in the sense that if you look at the past of life or evolution in the planet Earth, what is striking are the holes in our ability to understand what's happening. So the development of language is something totally, it's a black hole, we just don't know how to connect. And so also the disappearance of species of dinosaurs or whatever. So it's very important to understand that there are big holes in our understanding of the past evolution, and so big questions about what we can anticipate of the future of the transformation of humanity. Second point is that there is a really neglected aspect in how we are able to govern and to handle this transformation. And this is because most of the discussion are about the ethical or moral aspects and the possibility and the access of everybody to this option, so to say, so kind of marketized access or equality. But it is neglected the problem of the room for choice. If, for example, I choose out of my own personal ethical commitment that my children will not have any brain enhancement, they will go at school and find them at a disadvantage.
Yes, yeah.
So the actual room of choice is completely different kind of problem compared to access or to ethical yes. or moral things.
Yes, no, okay. Take your last point first. This is why I bring up the national health example. I have a new book coming out this month, I guess, end of this month, called Preparing for Life and Humanity 2.0. And I developed this National Health Service example that I alluded to in my remarks. And the point of that is to actually take into account that it is likely, as you suggest, that through market forces, certain people are going to try certain kinds of enhancements and get a kind of advantage. And then the question becomes, what happens to the people who don't have it, who can't afford it, can't get access to it in some way? Well, see, this, I think, is going to be an issue that National Health Service, you know, as we have in the UK, will have to be on top of in the future. In other words, make it equally available. If it does enable a competitive advantage of the kind you're talking about, then it should be like eyeglasses, right? It should be something that, as it were, is available because it becomes part of the normal threshold for living, right? And that's one of the ways in which you might say through market forces, we're being enhanced all the time, right? Because if enough people adopt something that actually does give them a competitive advantage, there's then a public interest in having everyone get it. And I do think that's going to be kind of the direction it goes, and it's going to be a new item, I think, on the welfare and health agendas of states in the future. So that's the one point. The first point you were raising, it slipped my mind. Just give me a little summary. The anticipatory governance.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I remember now. Yeah. I think that the thing about anticipatory governance I mean, again, this is where always it's interesting to see where did the idea come from, because it didn't come from us. Though the STS people are the ones who've been the great main beneficiaries. But, you know, the National Science Foundation in the United States was very concerned that, you know, okay, nanotechnology research so far hasn't realized all the promises it claimed, but maybe it will at some point, given the amount of money being put into it. And at that point, there's already enough kind of negative publicity out there that might scare people about gray goo and stuff like that. And so what you need is a strategy to get people used to the idea already, before it happens, that this stuff is going to come on stream and it won't kill them. Right? So you, in a sense, so one of the reasons why you run these scenarios and you have these Wikimedia and these consensus conferences and these focus groups that STS people do is to get people talking about it, get them used to it. It's kind of an immunization strategy. So they're no longer scared of it. Right? So in a sense, the STS people are kind of the vanguard of this new technology before it comes on stream. So it's anticipatory in that sense, right? It's not making a kind of prediction that is not likely to happen, you know, it's not like a falsifiable prediction. No, it's rather paving the way so people expect it and maybe even want it after a while, so they encourage funding, right? Because if the nano stuff doesn't happen next year, you want to keep the funding going, so you want people to think, yeah, there's something there, keep on funding it. You see, and that's what anticipatory governance is about. It's about that, okay? Yes, exactly. It's a kind of promissory governance. That's right.
Any last question to Thomas?
It's actually a couple of those questions. The whole normativity issue, I think, is very interesting because really what's happening, I think, in this discussion and what characterizes the discussion is that normativity isn't, you might want to think it's primary, we want to say morals and ethics is the way the discussion gets raised, but really everybody grants that it's science-driven, research-driven, empirically driven. So the first question is what kind of creature is man, what could it possibly be, this kind of thing. That's an empirical question leading to the sciences, biological and social, what's the space, right? So the normative issue usually only arises afterwards. And I think if we actually really thought about this very seriously and, like I say, went back and said, what if our understanding was literary and artistic before it became scientific, started there, and then said, okay, what are the normative issues, right? Then I think it's true that we would think about distribution, right? We would think about access to technology. But I think an interesting consequence of that is if we took all the technology that we have today and said, before we invent anything new, we have to distribute access to that to everybody. Mm-hmm. First of all, that project will take the next 200 years, right? So we wouldn't invent anything new, we would just be distributing, which I think would be a good idea. And secondly, if we had done that 100 years ago, how much better would life be then? Yeah, we wouldn't have iPhones, right? But we would have really well-made, like, wooden chairs.
Oh, well, then, I'm off the bus there.
The biggest bottle here.
The lesson here is to switch from science or from the empirical to the normative, from science to politics in a serious sense, and make the political primary. And that's going to have really radical consequences for our views about innovation. Because I think the only thing that drives innovation today is our fear of our neighbor getting better stuff than we have. Right? So that's really the game. If we didn't have that game, if the whole challenge was how do I give my neighbor the stuff I have, right? Then we would have a very different kind of social project. And I think that's what I'm arguing for. I think that's
so poetry is like a, for socialism, that's what you mean.
Yeah, so there would still be room for poetry in the socialist utopia.
Yeah.
But I think the idea here is to say that it would be better to let the ability to make stuff well, which is really just what poetry kind of stands for, right? The sort of the makingness of stuff, right? To make that primary, right? The ability to make stuff, that's human, right? Not the ability to think, not the ability to compute, not the ability to build technology or language or cognition or anything like that, but just this making, right? If that was primary, that artisanry was primary, then we would be living in a different world we could start doing that today.
Anyway, thank you very much. Please come back and do a talk. More questions? There'll be more fiery discussion at 2 o'clock. Right, Jim?
Thank you. We just turned this off.